Welcome to Pub Natter, where we record each episode in a different pub in Rutland, the smallest county in England. In each episode, your hosts, Tim and Justin, give a voice to the landlords and landladies and a special guest with a specific area of interest or expertise. We hope you enjoy our chats and it encourages you to go and explore our little county and all it has to offer. Like the motto says, there is much in little. This episode was recently recorded at the Wheatsheaf in Oakham, Rutland. We have plenty of topics to discuss with our multi-talented special guest, Tracy Dean Powell, who is a songwriter, scriptwriter, poet, blogger, author, radio presenter, and podcaster. When rain stops play, it's time for some pub natter.
And now we're with our special guest, Tracy Dean Powell. I've actually had to write down everything you've done that I took off your website to introduce you so I don't miss anything out. So here we go. Songwriter, scriptwriter, poet, blogger, author and podcaster. That's a few to be going on with, isn't it?
Yeah. And radio presenter.
And radio. Sorry, I missed one out. Anything else?
That's all right.
So let's take you back to the beginning then, after King Edward School.
Yeah.
What happened then?
Right. Well, I started doing my A-levels, but after the first year, my mum had to have a serious talk to me and say, really, Tracy, we cannot afford, even if you get your A-levels, we cannot afford to provide and invest in you or
sure.
You know, support
yeah.
you. So back in those days, again, it was quite common where my sisters went into the factory and then they would bring home some board and they'd pay board for, and then they'd
sure,
get married.
Yeah.
And so I knew I wanted something more than what I'd in a factory, but that's how I had to start out.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to Tithby Farm Dairies, which was based in Bottisford. They probably still are, but it's a cheese dairy. And I started there, and I went to night school to learn shorthand and typing because I knew that was a route out to a better career.
Mm-hmm.
So, I started then, and when I've got my qualifications of typing and shorthand, I then got a job at Pira.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is in Melton.
Yeah, opposite Sainsbury's.
I didn't know it had been there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been there. Long? Yeah, it's been there a long, long time.
I did some work with him about 20 years ago.
Did you? Yeah. Well, that's where I met my husband, because I was in personnel. I got a job first in the liaison office and then went to personnel, and we met on a first aid course all those years ago.
So yet again, we're interviewing somebody who's been very successful in life who didn't go to university?
No, not at all. No, it was pure...
current running theme, this is.
Pure graft just wanting to not work in the factory, and that's not being derogatory at all about people who work in factories, not at all. It wasn't my thing, and I just wanted to sort of be more comfortable in what I wanted to do. So shorthand and typing got me into personnel, which I loved because I'm a very people's person and I like helping, and I used to do the interviews, and it was great. And then I went into a state agency, and I ended up at West Bridgford for a company called Gascoigne's. And I thoroughly enjoyed that work. Really, really did enjoy a state agency because you do end up, in some respects, being almost a I won't say a counsellor, but you do listen to certain stories. You're a listener for these people because you have marriage breakups where the house is having to get sold, and you get the whole story, and you get bereavement and probate. And so again, it fitted in with a role of caring, really.
Sure. There's also an artistic side to it, isn't there, as well? Because you're having to paint a picture of their future.
Yeah, exactly. And I loved the extremes of working in Nottingham, because in the morning I could be valuing a terraced house in the Meadows, which is a poorer area of Nottingham, it was then. And then in the afternoon, I'd be in Ed Walton, valuing a £500,000 house. So I really had quite a sort of broad and diverse marketing region there. So I enjoyed that. And then I moved into Melton because I wanted to be nearer. I felt with any sales job, a marketing job, and I got caught up in this, that I wouldn't say no. So if somebody wanted a viewing on a Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, I'd do it. If someone wanted a valuation at 7 o'clock at night, I would do it because it was commission-based. I had a good salary, but I was on commission-based. I had commission on the sales. I had commission on the mortgages and finance. So I had a nice company car. So I had all the trappings of a successful salesperson, which I was. And I felt I'd sold my soul to the devil because I was not switching off. I was living 24/7 really. And I just suddenly just happened, it just dawned on me that, what are you doing? You know.
Did something happen to trigger that?
I'm not quite sure. I think it was just, you think when you've got money, you're going to be happy. And when that realization, yes, I could afford the nice holidays and had a nice house and whatever, and all the material things, but it wasn't fulfilling me as a person spiritually, I guess. And when I felt I wasn't happy and the happiness grew, I just felt I had to do something for me, and that was to get out of the environment because it wasn't healthy for me.
It's quite cutthroat at times, isn't it? Estate agency and selling finance and things like that.
It was then, yeah, yeah. And I just felt that I had a responsibility to these people, you know, to show people around their houses or if they wanted evaluation because they worked. I felt I had to sort of help them by being accommodating. But yeah, I mean, the more successful I was, the more money I was earning. And yeah, it was nice earning all that money. But when it doesn't sit right spiritually, when you're not happy with this getting up at 6 o'clock and it's full on days and you're constantly thinking, you're constantly looking at where you can make more money or whatever, then it went against everything that I am, the person I am, and I came out of it. It wasn't hard to do. It really wasn't hard to do. I was quite happy just to come out of that.
So you've made an enormous leap from that into all of the artistic stuff that you're doing now.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, I've never made a living out of writing, but writing has always been my constant. I've always pushed myself as a writer. So when I started writing songs with my guitar, I then came up, we had a band, there was three of us. We had a band, my husband being one member, he played the bass, and a very good friend, Chris Arnold, he was on acoustic guitar and vocals, and he also was a very talented pianist, so he was on keyboards. And the three of us got together, and we called ourselves Diversion, because we felt we were diverting away from the mainstream of things, we would, whenever we played out, we would do three covers, one of our own, and we never charged. What we would do, however, is raise money for various charities, and we released a CD, and again, we wanted to make it available to most people to purchase, so we didn't go silly. It was only, I think it was £2.50, because it wasn't about making the money, it was about raising money. But we raised over £1,000 for Macmillan, just purely for the sales of the CD. So
that's good.
Whenever we played out, there would just be a bucket, and whatever good cause that fate or that, you know, event was trying to raise money for, we just put a bucket there and people would just put money in.
Still available?
Well, sadly,
do people buy CDs anymore?
Well, they don't buy CDs, but most of my songs are on my YouTube channel,
which is called
Tracy Dean Powell. So yeah, anyone that Googles Tracy Dean Powell, my website comes up. But also, if you go onto YouTube and just put Tracy Dean Powell, most of my songs are on there. But yeah, it was a good time with the band, and it was a rewarding time with recording. And I've always wanted to push myself as a writer. My next challenge for myself when I was doing songwriting, it was to say to myself, I wonder if I could do a musical. You know, I wonder what that would be like. So I got writing and I did this play. And it was originally in three parts. The first part was based in World War I trenches. The second part of it was a 60s, based in a factory in the 60s. And the third was an up-to-date young man, would say, monologues. And a good friend of mine, William Ivory, who's written The Escaper and Made in Dagenham, I said to Billy...
I know the person that wrote the music to that.
Do you?
David Arnold.
Oh, small world.
Yeah.
Small world.
Shout out to David.
Yeah, shout out to David.
Because he's really good at listening. Actually, his nephew wrote our music for the, podcast. Yeah.
Oh, how fantastic
is
that? Oh, well done. Fantastic. Well, small world. We were just talking about being a small world.
Absolutely.
The odds of that. Well, I spent some time with Billy and he read it and he said to me, to be honest, Tracy, you've got three musicals here. And even I'd be thinking, whew, this is going to be some production because, you know, I think you'd be daunted by it. He said, so I would take one section out and just do a thorough job on that. So I took his advice and I took the first part out, which was based in World War I trenches, because I knew I could do it easily, acoustically, with a guitarist and a pianist. So I did that, and but he said, yeah, you know, just do it well, Tracy, because war is a very sensitive subject, and if you don't do it well, it will come and bite you in the bum. And I said, yeah, okay. So I did the script, and it was called Phantom Love, and because I'm a very spiritual person, it's based a lot on about angels, about people who you lose, they don't leave you, they stay with us and they will always be with us.
But do you believe that?
Yeah, I do. And that's because I've had my own personal experiences of angels or mm-hmm. Of people, my parents and whatever. So the play or the musical, because I'm a three chord wonder, I suppose, with the guitar, I can't write scores, you know, I'm a
work for
folk
Bob Dylan.
Singer. Well, yeah, that's Bob Dylan.
Beatles. Status quo.
So yeah, I mean status quo is I love their music and I would class myself as a three chord wonder with a few sevenths and minors thrown in, and I've just managed to surround myself with some very talented musicians. So whenever we went to the studio, I had professional people who are my friends meet it out and help with the arrangements. So when I did the musical, I worked for 3 years alongside a very talented musician who transposed all my songs, which were very folky, and he transposed them all into full scores for an orchestra. So it took 3 years to do, but we did it. And I then, it's all right writing it. I thought, well, I need to put this out there. So I put it on the Wissendine Village Hall. But I so believed in it that I wrote to the directors of Curve. And I said, please come as a guest. Come and see it. And if you like it, could I do it at Curve? So, unfortunately, the director, we were messaging each other, but he couldn't make it on the night. So, not giving up, I said, okay, that's fine. I'll record it, and I'll meet you for a coffee, and I'll show you it. And that is what happened. I met with the director, showed him bits of the musical that we'd recorded, and he really liked it. And so he said, yeah, okay. He said, you find a cast, and I'm happy for you to be putting it on at Curve. So then I thought, right, next dilemma, you know, where do I find a cast from? So I then invited various schools and colleges to see if they were interested, and Katmas College and...
When was this?
This was back in 2000 and I think it would be about 16, something like that.
Just missed my boys, you see. My oldest son's an actor.
Oh, gosh. Well, it was Leanne.
And both of them have worked at Curve.
Sorry, who was
it? Both of my sons have worked at Curve.
Oh, really?
Not on the stage, but in the theatre, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a small world.
It is such a small world, yeah. It was great because Katmas College took it to Curve. That was a big learning curve for me because to start with, they said to hire, because they said I could have the studio or the main auditorium. And me being me, I said, no, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it. I want the main theatre. So they said, well, it'll cost you £2,000 for the day for the main theatre. And that would be two performances, matinee and evening. And I thought, okay, I can take the hit on this if it needs to be. So then as we got into the production and the performances or the rehearsals and whatever, then it got to the first six rows had to be taken out because of the orchestra, and they have to have their people do that. Ka-ching. Then, of course, after the performances, you have to put these six rows back. Ka-ching. Then Katmas wanted a big projector screen on the back. Ka-ching, ka-ching. we had all their lighting. It had to be their lighting guys, their stage guys, and it all started to mount up. And that's when I really had to kick into all my marketing and sales experience. And I did a program, and I sold advertising in the program. So it was a very busy time, and the production went ahead, and we had great reviews. BBC Radio Leicester followed the story, and they were very complimentary, and they said to me, Tracy, actually, we think the children here have learned more from doing this play or this musical than ever in a book. And I can see that because they actually lived these parts. And it was great seeing one particular young lad. He lacked self-confidence. He was very shy. And by the end of this production and this performance, you could physically see him change. And it transformed him, which was great. So the total production cost at the end...
This is what listeners are... This is the bit that they want to hear.
£10,000. £10,000 it cost in the end.
Well, this is going back a few years as well.
It's going back a few years, so it was a lot of money. And not only did I manage to cover it with the cost from selling advertising and getting sponsorship, but also we managed to give, I think it was about £150, £200 to the local Rutland Cancer Charity. So it was a very stressful time.
So you break even?
Yeah, we didn't we paid the 10,000 and yep. then we were able to give over. Yeah, and that I think it was 150 or something we gave to the Rutland Cancer Charity. So it,
that sounds yeah. almost like the plot line to the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, it was a stressful time. I can tell you, it was a very very sort of a
take this, give it to the Sisters of Mercy, give the rest of the band.
Yeah, it was a and you think at the end of the performances, you know, I'd be on a high and I'd be celebrating, and in fact, I was absolutely totally exhausted, and it was. I was drained, so there wasn't actually any celebrations. Oh, you know, I've done this. It wasn't until a while afterwards that we started getting. Apparently, Katmas got inundated by people writing and saying how much they'd enjoyed it and how well the pupils had done and the students had done. But it's a proud moment now. I think not bad, but at the time, phew, blimey.
On reflection, but yeah. Is it something that you would do again?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I think if I was passionate enough to believe in something, yes, I would. If I felt strongly that that play or that music or whatever was worth doing, yes, I think I would. Because at the time, my boss, I had to sign this big contract, and it was like 20 pages long, this contract. You know, because and basically it's the curve was just passing everything on to, you know, everything that could go wrong is my responsibility. So I had to take public liability insurance out, I had to take this, that, and the other, and I had to sign this document. And I said to my boss, oh, I don't know whether I can do it. And he just sat there and goes, well, don't do it then. I said, no, I've got to do it. He says, well, sign it then. I said, oh. So I signed it. So, yeah, and that was my musical. So then from writing a script and finding that I enjoyed writing the script, I then wanted to challenge myself again as a writer and think, can I write comedy? Because comedy is such a... it's Marmite, isn't it?
No, it's not.
You either like somebody or you don't.
That's absolutely true.
You know, you could... And so there's a bit in me that... I guess must thrive on insanity.
So who are your... Who's your kind of like comedy giants then?
Well, it's got to be... I mean... To watch comedy and to laugh out loud, you've got your Gavin and Stacey kind of comedy, your light-hearted comedy, and even going back years, you know, like your Butterfly.
I love butterflies. I shouldn't, but I do.
So light-hearted, things that are quite observational, but yeah, and I
Dad's Army?
Yeah, Dad's Army. I just love that side.
You like something that's got a little bit of poignancy?
Yes, yeah.
So they're creating and characters, really, aren't
characters,
they? And you invest in the characters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But there's a sort of bittersweet... All the ones that you mentioned, there's a sort of a bittersweet aspect to them.
I mean, the comedy's one... the comedy I've done has been... I've done about four now. The one that... took me out my comfort zone. I pushed my neck out a bit on it, and it was called Menopause Madness.
Did you get many men turning up for that one?
Yeah, strangely enough, it was so funny. I did three performances on it, and at the end of each performance, it was so funny because women would conquer in little groups, and the men would just like stand there going, oh, "I've lived through that." Oh, I've lived through that. So it was like this camaraderie.
So it's a stand-up you were doing?
No, what it was based in a therapist session. So I think there was five actors. One, two, three, four, five, six. Six actors. A male therapist. And then the women who were there to get counselling or help because of the menopause. But one of... the characters was a transgender. Now, when I I'd written this and I wanted to perform it. It was at the same time as there was this bit of hoo-ha in Hollywood where a straight actor was going to play a transgender role, and there was this uproar saying that you should be using a transgender actor. So I thought, ooh, I've got to be careful here. Otherwise, I'm going to land myself in really serious trouble.
So was the transgender character suffering from the menopause?
Because of the change. She was going through a change. And they take hormone supplements and therapy. So they have to go through that change. And I contacted transgender organisations, and I managed to find someone called Katie, who had just announced that she no longer wanted to be known as Martin, and she was now completely come out as Katie. So it was a very vulnerable time for Katie, and she'd never acted before, but she was willing to give this a go. So Katie came on board, which was great, because then I had a transgender doing a transgender role. So it wasn't about the transgender, it was about these other women and how collectively they all talked about that. And it was a comedy, so they were talking about, you know, hot flushes and, you know.
Sounds very so. Victoria Wood.
Yeah, in
Jenny
many ways.
Eclair.
Yeah.
I took my wife to see Jenny Eclair.
Yeah.
And I walked into this place, and I was the only man there. And then after about 20 minutes, and the place was filling up, another man emerged, but he was in a wheelchair, so he clearly had no choice because his wife was pushing him. And I sat there, and we were in the second row, and she was like from here to the bar away. And I've never felt so vulnerable in my life. I thought, if she picks on me, because she's so quick, if she picks on me, I am just toast.
It's funny you say that, because we went to De Montfort, and it was the Full Monty, and I went there with my husband, and we went there, and there's only about six men there in the bar area, but they all congregated together. It was like this,
defensive posture.
It was, yeah. All sorts of women. So yeah, I get that. And the play, the Menopause Madness, went down really, really well, and I was really pleased with that, because it could have been. You know, you don't know how the audience will react.
In it anyway, really, couldn't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Confused.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
Shocked.
But Katie now, she's won numerous awards. Numerous awards. She's, if you Google Katie Neves, she's, she does a BBC podcasts for the BBC now. She's come a long way. From doing that, from my little play, being in it. So, yeah, as a writer, I've pushed on the comedy side of things. And then I wanted to... I've always been with the radio, 103 The Eye. I've been with them about 12 years now as a presenter.
So for those who aren't aware of them, explain.
Yeah, 103 The Eye Community Radio Station is based in Melton Mowbray.
Is it online?
It's on FM and online. So
does FM still exist?
Yeah, we've got it on FM, 103 FM.
Blimey. Frequency modulation is still there.
You can.
I thought everything was digital now.
No, so you can hear it in the car and everything. So so people do listen on FM, but of course
it'd
you're
have
right.
to be an old car.
Well, I don't know. I can get it in my car. But also, you're right, Tim, that you can get it. A lot of people stream. A lot of people listen to it, and my relatives in America, they tune in because I do an afternoon show, so it's early morning there for them. I've got people in South Africa that tune in and listen to it. But I started my presenting way back as a singer-songwriter, because I went as a guest on the radio to sing live on radio. So after I'd done that, the producer said, you know, you're not interested in joining us, are you? And I was like, oh, okay. And it's been great. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I stream in from home now, which is a lot better saves time in travelling back and forth.
So what does your show involve?
Inspirational stories and quotes. So it's an upbeat show. Sure. So people can request all sorts of music, but it's sort of middle of the road music. It's music is not your heavy metal and it's not your extremes. But I look out for inspirational quotes and stories because I think people need uplifting.
Certainly do nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. And it started off in COVID because I used to record and send it in to the studio. And again, using humour, because back then, if you remember, it was like everyone was cooking and everyone was clapping and everyone was doing all these funny things. So I wrote and produced shows for the Eye and sent them in, and Christine would put them together. So it started off from there. So when I was able to get back into the studio, I kept on that theme, really, of uplifting stories.
So where'd you get the stories on your quotes from?
A lot on social media. I scan Instagram and Facebook and papers, articles, and if you look, there's quite a few inspirational people, which then led me to do my podcast, More Than a Woman.
Oh, okay. So how long's that been around?
We started that just before Christmas.
Okay, so not long.
So not long.
So you're like us, you're quite new at the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
What advice would you give us from what you've learned so far?
What you're doing, guys, which is making...
Find something else to do with your time.
I think it's just making it relaxed and informal, and I think that's the beauty of it, because it's if you can make a relaxed atmosphere and as if you talking in a pub, chatting away, two mates or three mates chatting away, and that I think is what...
No, we're not mates. He likes me.
Well, I didn't like to say it.
Oh dear.
So yeah, so that's you know, and it works for us. And we were talking earlier about people who we've interviewed, and you were saying Alicia Kearns. And Alicia was the first female to come on and can be interviewed with More Than a Woman. And we interview inspirational women.
So it's called More Than a Woman, but it's only women?
It is only women.
So why are you dissing like 50% of the population in that podcast of your potential listeners?
Well, I think it's because as a woman, I think...
Thinking very hard what to say now.
Yeah.
Good tell.
I think as a woman, it's nice to have a voice and to help. I think women have a great capacity to support and help one another. And I think women have had a real rough ride over the years in lots of things like imbalance of salaries for a start. Women have come under, we were talking earlier about how they're just targets or seeming to be targets for any ruthless journalist that wants to make a pop at them. Successful women, intelligent, successful women, and they're being, you know, photographed and spawned about how they look, and it's disgraceful. So More Than a Woman was...
I agree with all what you said, but don't you think if you want to make a change, then you need to attract the male audience?
Well, that probably will come, Tim. I think at the minute, what we're trying to do is to build a podcast that women can listen to gain support and an understanding. And I think if we invited men in at this stage, I think... we will probably be like any other podcast out there.
So a reminder of the name of the podcast.
It's called More Than a Woman.
And available on all platforms.
Yeah, on all platforms.
Spotify, Apple.
Yeah. And I team up with a lady called Sarah Robb. And Sarah Robb runs a menopause cafe in Melton. And she runs an exercise group in Melton as well.
Cool.
So it's... I keep myself busy.
Certainly do. And then you still had time to write books.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this one, because this is in front of me now.
Yep.
Onkar's Adventure at Rutland Water.
Yes, it's about the Rutland Panther.
Well, yeah, it's got a big Rutland Panther on the front. So have you seen it?
Well, I've seen some. You have?
I'm 99% sure I saw something.
Yeah.
I was coming through just before you get to, from Langham, just before you get to Barleythorpe.
Yeah.
And it was probably about 50 yards in front of me. This big black thing did saunter across the road. I thought
it's called a Labrador.
Yeah. It looked like that. It looked like the front of your book.
Brilliant.
So yeah. Well, have you?
There's a Labrador
sniffing. Yeah, I've seen something that, again, you think, that was big, and it was on its own. You think, oh, it's a lonesome big animal strolling across
the
field.
That's an escaped Labrador.
So, I mean, I suppose it could be a badger. It could have been a badger because they're large animals, aren't they? But
they're not as big as a panther.
But they're not as big as a panther, you see, and they don't look like a little
Labrador.
If I saw
a badger as big as a panther, I'd be really scared.
There you go.
Because there are lots of badgers and there's only one panther.
There is, exactly.
If the panther-sized badgers ganged up on me, I'll tell you what, we could have a bit of a change in the apex species.
So I'm looking through the book and I can see, I want to bring some sanity back into the conversation.
Don't do that.
There's a map of Rutland Water and with lots of creatures on it and some really nice pictures. So I'm guessing that Tracy Dean Powell is the author. Who did the illustrations?
Right, a very talented illustrator called Kevin Beckham. And the relationship we have, Kevin and myself, Kevin was involved in the soundtrack that we did. He plays Badger and the Bats. And originally, again, because my world, if you like, is script writing and music, mm-hmm. I took 8 actors and 2 musicians to a studio because my thoughts were I wanted to do a bit like a Peter and the Wolf. I mean, I was brought up with Peter and the Wolf and I just I love capturing the child's imagination with music, using music, because I think music is so powerful. It touches the heart, it reaches the soul, and characters. And so I wanted to produce a soundtrack, and it's 70 minutes long, this soundtrack, with all these different characters and different genres of music coming in. And I wanted to make this completely free for every child. So I was brought up with Peter and the Wolf. So I wanted to produce something that children, any child, no matter where they are in the world, they could listen to and enjoy the story. And in the story, you've got little messages like the crow and the panther. They become best friends, but they're always, to start with, comparing each other's strengths and weaknesses. And the message is never compare yourself, because we're all special, we're all beautiful, we've all got our own strengths. Don't ever compare. So there's little messages in this book all mm-hmm. the time about when Onka has to have that leap of faith into the water to be, he thinks he's going to drown, but he's not, he's saved. But in life, sometimes you have to have that leap of faith and believe that something's going to work out okay. So there's little messages all the way in it, and that's why I wanted to make it free for every child. Now, Kevin was involved in that soundtrack, but because he's an amazing illustrator, he had said to me, have you thought about doing a physical book, Tracy, to accompany the soundtrack?
So I'm just looking over Tim Shilder at some of the illustrations, and they are amazing.
So Kevin said, well, let's do a hard book then to accompany the soundtrack. So I did that, but then I didn't want to be arrogant as a writer, thinking, oh, I've just written this children's book, yay, great, without having some proof that children actually liked it. So that's when I got Langham Primary School involved. And
Why Langham?
Because they were the next school. Well, I could have used Whissendine, but Diane Rowland, she'd already helped me with a book that when my friend passed away, I'd promised him I would publish his book. which I did, and I gave free copies to every pupil in Langham School because he lived in Langham. So I'd already had this contact with Diane, the head teacher. So it was just a natural thing for me to say, well, Diane, I've had a go at writing a children's storybook. Can you trial it for me and see what the children think? And she kindly did. And the feedback we got was, A, the children loved it, which was what I wanted to hear. But they actually came up with the map. They wanted a map. It didn't have a map in to start with. It was the children that said, can we have a map? So we created this map, and that map is when we got Johnny Young from Rutland Water involved, the manager, because we were saying, right, Johnny, you know, we're producing this book. Can you help us with a map? He says, yeah, I've got one here. So that map in the book is based on a fisherman's map that Johnny gave us. So all the lovely names like New Zealand Point and Carrot Corner, they are actual names on Rutland Water that the fishermen use when they go fishing. So that's brilliant. Where the map came from. So
the lesson there is, if you want to write a book, ask a bunch of kids.
Exactly. Well, if you're going to write a children's book, yeah, because they're your biggest critics. If they didn't engage with it, then it was no good. How good I thought something was, you know, my ego going, oh, yeah, I think this is good. No, the proof is a child, if the child enjoys it. And so that was great. And then David and Jean Penny, who live in Wissendine, and David plays Onka, the panther. He was a voice actor. They sponsored me then, and they gave me enough money to give free copies of the book to every primary school in Rutland, every primary school in Melton Mowbray, every school in surrounding Leicestershire villages, and every primary school in Lincolnshire. Yes, wow. So we've given over 1,000 books to schools.
I'm a voracious reader, and one of the things that I always struggle with, how do you come up with your characters' names? So where did Onkar come from?
Onkar came from, during COVID, I went to see a lovely friend. He was elderly, and I became his little bubble. But he was a biology teacher in his career before he retired. And I said about writing the book, and he helped me with the characters of like what kind of attributes that character would have, that animal or bird would have. So he helped an awful lot with those characters. And Onka is a breed of panther. It's actually... Oh. And so it explains in there. So
every day is a school day. I didn't even know there was more than one.
So it's a type of a panther. So that's where Onka, the name, came from. But yeah, Bob Sheridan, he helped me with all the characteristics of how badger would be, and what kind of instrument could we use, and the osprey, and so he helped an awful lot. But sadly, he passed away. It's an honour of him. It's there. So yeah, it was great fun to produce and to do.
How's it going? Is it
very, very well? I mean, we've got it on local stock. It's again, we didn't want to put it on Amazon as a team. We felt that we wanted to support local community and local businesses. So it can't be found on Amazon, but it can be found in Walker's Bookshops, Foxy Lots in Melton, Rutland Nursery, Gates Nursery, Ashwell, Warner Sweets. So there's various stockists and outlets that are selling the book. And with the money that we're getting from the book, once expenses have gone out, I've written a second book, and it's again going to be an educational storybook for children. And so the money we're using is going to be ploughed into that, because I really feel a buzz to do that.
Are you going to give us a scoop?
It's going to be introducing children or inspiring children to travel to different countries and learn about different cultures and countries and inspire them to travel, because I've done an awful lot of travelling these last couple of years, and it broadens the mind so much, and it balances you as human, and you look at poverty you go to India, you go to Cambodia, you visit where there's poverty, and then you come back to England and say, we live in poverty. Different kind of poverty. You know, so it's broadened me. So I just want to inspire children to go and say, I'd like to go to India, Mummy, or I'd like to visit the Nile, Mummy, I'd like to go, you know, because if you can afford to take children and teach them a different culture in a different country, it will make them a more balanced human being or adult.
So future plans. So the next thing is going to be the book.
Oh, yeah. The next thing is the children's book, and I'm looking at illustrators to help me with that, because I may just go on a different feel on that. And I've written my very first thriller play. Mm-hmm. And that will be performed at Whissendine next year. So I've got a first reading with the cast in a couple of weeks, just to tweak it or see if they like the characters. Because I, with everything I do with my plays, I say to the actors, though I've written it, it's not mine, because it's only as good as you make it and you make the characters come alive. So what I've done on paper is one thing, but what you do on stage, you are creating the play. And so I always involve them. So if they feel that that character wouldn't do that, or they'd say, they add a bit and say, oh yeah, keep that in, that's really good, because they get into that character. So it's really a fun part fun process when you start rehearsals, because you see these characters evolving on stage and you see the actors really getting into the character. And then I tweak all the time, you know, because I think, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, I keep that. And I direct all my plays as well. So seeing them move on stage and you know, and it's a great fun process. But yeah, I always say to them, don't think because I've written this play, it's my play. It's not. I may be the script writer, but without your skills and your talent and your commitment on stage, it'll be nothing. And you know, so you go to see a production, and if the actors aren't particularly, you know, hot or identified, it could be a cracking written play.
Yeah, you're right.
Yep. But if they're not acting right. So, I put my faith into the actors and...
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Do you know, you've just done so much, haven't you? You've got so much going on. I'm just kind of wondering how you've kind of fit it all in.
I think I've got a passion for living, and I think and I love writing. Obviously, I love writing and pushing myself as a writer, I enjoy it. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. But yeah, I think every day is a gift. You know, my sister died at 55, so I'm already 5 years ahead of her. So I don't take life for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Our band member, Chris, I talked about diversion earlier on, three of us, sadly, Chris passed away with cancer 3 years ago. So I think I've never taken life for granted, and I want to get as much out of it. And with writing... if I can bring joy to somebody, and if my work can affect somebody, you know, or help somebody or make someone smile or say, I've enjoyed that, Tracy, whether it be my song or my play or my books or whatever, then for me, that's the greatest feeling in the world. Someone has enjoyed my work. It gets no better than that. At my funeral, I want the guy or woman at the top saying, well, where do I start?
Well, that sounds like a very good place to finish.
That's a perfect place to finish. Tracy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. That was inspiring.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Really enjoyed it.
It's been lovely chatting to you.
Thank you. So, that's a wrap. And thank you for listening to our latest Pub Natter. If you visit timothyives.com/pubnatter, you will find photos, links, and more information about each episode,
In our next podcast, we travel back to the Railway Inn in Ketton, Rutland, for a quick catch-up with the landlord, Jamie Betts. The Railway Inn has just won the Camera Rutland Pub of the Year, so we were determined to help him celebrate. Our special guest at the Railway Inn is Henry Winter, the chief football writer for The Times. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and please subscribe to ensure you don't miss a pub or one of our amazing guests. The Pub Natter theme tune is by Tom Arnold. That was a Pub Natter broadcast.